branch, which is called Branwen, daughter of Thir, we have completely new characters. Branwen is the sister of Bran the Blessed, king of Britain. The king of Ireland, Matholwch, asks for her hand in marriage, which Bran grants. But because Branwen's half-brother, Efnisien, is not consulted on the matter, Efnisien angrily mutilates the horses of the Irish delegation, and a lasting resentment is created. Once Branwen is back in Ireland, she produces a son, Gwern, but she is badly treated at the Irish court, and the king forces her to work in the kitchens. She trains a starling to bring word of her predicament back to King Bran, who invades Ireland on her behalf. I should mention here that Bran is a giant. He is so large that he can wade across the Irish Sea. Once he arrives, Branwen makes peace between her husband and her brother, but war breaks out again due to Efnisien, who seizes his nephew Gwern and throws him on the fire. The two sides proceed to slaughter each other, though the action is prolonged by the fact that the Irish possess a magic cauldron that can bring the dead back to life. Bran is finally killed as well, and his head is cut off, though it continues to talk, and the head is then buried in London at the site of the later Tower of London, where it will supposedly ward off invasion. And this story may or may not be connected to the tradition that England will be safe as long as ravens live at the tower. The name Bran means crow in Welsh, and ravens are closely related to crows. Branwen also returns to Britain, only to die of grief. I won't describe the other two branches in detail, but they contain the same marvelous mixture of supernatural elements and human drama. Scholars have several different theories about what the Mabinogi is supposed to be about. Many scholars have claimed that these stories preserve original Celtic mythology. Characters such as Arawn and Rhiannon certainly seem to represent gods of some kind. One of the most interesting theories argues that the first branch of the Mabinogi preserves a memory of the raid of the Celts on Delphi in 270 BC. This is almost certainly not the case. As we have seen, it is highly unlikely that the people living in Wales in the Middle Ages had any particular connection to the Galatai who attacked Delphi in the 3rd century BC. This theory is a remnant of the old Celtic hypothesis that saw one overarching Celtic civilization preserving its tales throughout the Celtic areas down through the centuries. More recently, scholars have suggested that whatever the origins of these tales might be, and surely they do have their roots in ancient mythology in some fashion, their current form reflects a sophisticated literary sensibility. The style of the prose is highly polished and very pleasing, and there are subtle touches that weave the four tales together, even though it can be hard to see the connections at first blush, since they don't all contain the same characters. Not everybody loves the Mabinogi, but I do, and I highly recommend giving it a try. Finally, I want to mention a Welsh literary figure who lived a little bit later than the authors of the Mabinogi, during the period after the English conquest, the great poet Dafydd ap Gwilym. Dafydd lived in the middle of the 14th century, though we're unsure of the exact dates. He wrote with great wit and verve about both love and nature, and here are excerpts from just two of my favorites. The first is from The Girls of Llanbadarn.
I am bent with wrath, a plague upon all the women of this parish, for I've never had a single one.
The second is from a poem whose title I won't give away, but it might help to explain the poet's difficulties with women.
I always deemed my features bright and beautiful and fair, until yon mirror met my sight, when, lo, an ugly face was there. Thou blue-round moon, thou drear delusion, thou magnet-fashioned sorceress, thou world of dreams and dire confusion, ice-like in hue and brittleness, let hell consume the hateful, thin, bent-lipped mirror.
These poems truly are wonderful. We really feel we get to know the poet and his personal frustrations and delights. Despite the political difficulties the Welsh experienced, they were able to take refuge in a remarkable literary tradition that laid the foundations for what is arguably the strongest surviving Celtic language today.
Lecture 20, The Tudor Conquest of Ireland.
Welcome back. In this lecture, I'm going to pick up where I left off in an earlier lecture about Ireland in the Middle Ages and tell the story of the final clash between the English and the Irish that led to the Tudor conquest of Ireland. Along the way, we'll look particularly at the question of how Irish identity played a role in English policy in Ireland, and we'll use the example of the experience of one of the most important families in Irish history, the O'Neills, who had to figure out repeatedly where they stood on the spectrum between Irish and English identity. We'll also look at the English policy of plantation, which was a concerted effort to wipe out Irish culture, if not the Irish themselves, and turn Ireland into another England. This conflict obviously has deep roots in the Middle Ages. In my lecture on the English invasion of Ireland, I talked about how the English had never completely conquered Ireland, and as a result, there was an uneasy coexistence on the island between the Irish and the English settlers, many of whom adopted a great many aspects of Irish culture, including the Irish language, but for the most part, without changing their political allegiance. This situation was inherently unstable, and from the late 15th century through the 16th century, the English government tried a number of expedients in an effort to solve the Irish problem. For quite a while, these various experiments in policy just came and went, causing more or less exasperation among the English officials as they all failed in their turn. But the question of how to rule Ireland was suddenly crucially important in the 1530s, when Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church. All of a sudden, England was on the wrong side of the major Catholic powers in Europe, particularly Spain, which was especially aggrieved that the Reformation in England had been touched off by Henry's rejection of his Spanish bride, Catherine of Aragon. Ireland now represented a security threat for England because it was a perfect backdoor for the Spanish to use in a potential invasion of England. There was a precedent for this. Way back in the late 15th century, after the Tudor victory and the Wars of the Roses, two Yorkist pretenders actually invaded England from Ireland, and they had foreign help. In fact, one of them was helped by Scotland. So the English were very afraid of their Spanish enemies joining forces with the Irish. And the religious factor did not help matters. Naturally, the English tended to identify Catholicism with disloyalty and the threat of invasion by Catholic powers. Now, in Ireland, almost all of the native Irish stayed Catholic, plus a very large proportion of the English settler community also stayed Catholic. The Spanish king was likely to listen with a sympathetic ear to pleas for help from Catholics in Ireland, and that was very dangerous to the English, especially because now the settlers and the native Irish might make common cause on religious grounds. So this made Ireland seem like even more of a threat to the English authorities. From the 1530s on, in addition to military action when required, the English government pursued two other main avenues towards pacification in Ireland, and they assumed that these two approaches were in harmony with each other. The first was Anglicization. The English assumed that one of the main reasons why the Irish opposed English rule was that they were savages. If they were persuaded of the superiority of the English way of life and of English government, they would naturally consent to be ruled peacefully by the English king. The second approach was Protestantization. Again, the English government felt that the more the Irish could be brought to conform to the new English state religion, the more peaceful they would be. One of the most interesting experiments in this effort to convert the Irish to both Protestantism and Englishness came during the reign of Henry VIII. This was the policy that later historians have called surrender and regrant. The main idea was to try to turn the leaders of the Irish community into good English lords, and that would make them loyal. Then the lower social ranks in Ireland would naturally follow along. And it's the flip side of the assumption that if the English settlers are acting too Irish, their political loyalty must be suspect. Now, if you can change the culture of the Irish, if you can get them to act English, you might also change their political allegiance. Or so the English thought. This is how it worked. An Irish lord would acknowledge the king's authority in Ireland and receive in exchange a grant of the territory he already held, but it would be an official grant. Where previously the English government might not have recognized the Irish lord's right to the land, now his ownership would be sanctioned by the English state. If he was a major landowner, he would get an English title. He would be made the Earl of this or the Baron of that. Hereafter, he would be treated as English. He would be equal in law to an English nobleman. In return, he would be expected to adopt English customs and learn the English language. There's actually a famous contemporary engraving of an Irish lord doing this, surrendering his lands. And he is wearing English clothes and an English haircut as a sign of his willingness to follow the rules of the grant. The result of this adoption of English ways was supposed to be harmony between English and Irish. No more barriers would remain. And for the first time, it did seem realistic to think this might be achieved, at least on the legal front. Up until this point, the legal situation in Ireland had been very confused. In some areas, English law was followed. In other areas, the old Brehon law of traditional Irish society held sway. There were also many areas where the system in use was a kind of mishmash of English and Irish law called marcher law, named for the marches or border areas. But now, the English started trying to create a uniform English-style legal infrastructure for Ireland. They established new courts and expanded the system of justices of the peace into some of the previously purely Irish areas. Slowly but steadily, they crowded out the Brehon law, so that now, if someone wanted legal redress, they had to go to the English courts. Before this, the situation had been reversed. In the Irish areas, English people had to use Brehon law if they wanted any justice at all. So this all sounds good, right? Well, there were some structural difficulties with the surrender and regrant program, at least on the Irish side. One of the most important of these problems had to do with the differences between the ways in which the English and the Irish handled the ownership of land. Under the English system, title to land was held by a single individual. Under the Irish system, members of the extended family had certain rights in the land that could not be completely alienated by one landowner. These rights essentially disappeared under the surrender and regrant system. Surrender and regrant worked reasonably well in many cases, since the incentives for the chiefs were so clear. If the English acknowledged your title, they would leave you alone. That was worth going through a little ceremony and taking a wee oath or two. So during the course of 1541 and 1542, a steady stream of Irish chiefs presented themselves before the Lord Deputy to surrender their lands and receive them back with English-style titles. Probably the two most impressive catches were the two most important Irish chiefs from Ulster, Manus O'Donnell and Con O'Neill. But this change was not necessarily fine for all of the extended family members of these chiefs, who would be losing out. As you might expect, this would cause major friction within an Irish family where the rules of succession could already tend to foster family disputes. Thus, surrender and regrant, which was supposed to create more stability from the English perspective, could sometimes have the opposite effect. A key example of this tendency for the policy to destabilize the Irish lordships is the case of the surrender by Con O'Neill, who was made the first Earl of Tyrone. This was a huge propaganda success for the English. Now, in that submission, O'Neill made some substantial concessions. He promised to attend the Irish Parliament in Dublin, which from the English side was seen as a great privilege, of course. He promised to renounce the practice of charging black rent, which was basically a kind of protection money that Irish lords extracted from the beleaguered English settlers. He promised to renounce papal authority. There's the Protestant part of the equation. And he promised to keep the king's peace. So that was what Con O'Neill promised to do while he was alive. What would happen after his death? We will come back to that shortly. Sir Ender Henry Grant had a troubled legacy. It did succeed in integrating many Irish lords into the English system. But there was also some pushback from people who felt that Sir Ender Henry Grant was a betrayal of Irish culture. Prominent among these detractors were the Irish bards. Remember, these were exactly the people whom the English did not want their own people to patronize because they represented so much concentrated Irishness. There's a wonderful poem from this period written by Leashach MacInvard that really captures this dichotomy between the old Irish ways and the new English ways, and it certainly draws on the rich Irish tradition of satire. The poem draws a sharp contrast between a native Irish rebel named Owen Bawn and an unnamed Irish man who has been seduced by the new English style. The poet merely addresses him as the man who follows English ways. First, MacInvard criticizes his target for cutting his long flowing hair short in the English fashion. He compares him to a tonsured monk. And he criticizes him too for wearing English-style clothes, including a long satin scarf and a high Dutch collar. Remember, clothing and hairstyles were traditional points of contention between the English and the Irish. The poet also mocks the English-style weapon that the man who follows English ways carries. He calls it a blunt rapier that would not kill a fly. Basically, MacInvard is insulting the manhood of his victim. If the English thought that Irish ways were savage, the Irish thought that English ways were effeminate. Well, it became clear early on that Sir Ender Henry Grant was not going to put an end to Irish rebellions, so the English turned to another policy with far-reaching consequences in Irish history, plantation. The sense of the word here is that you will bring in English people and turn the area to be planted into a sort of island of Englishness. Plantation was a direct response to specific Irish rebellions. It was started in the 1540s and 50s in response to a revolt in the Irish Midlands, and then extended to the southwest in the 1580s. The legal basis for a plantation was the continued rebellion of the natives against royal authority. The way the English government proceeded was to issue bills of attainder against the rebels. A bill of attainder is a law passed against a named individual. Under these bills, their lands were confiscated. Now, bills of attainder are mentioned in the United States Constitution because Americans are not allowed to have bills of attainder. So Parliament passed laws against the specific Irish rebels whose lands they wanted to confiscate. Once the land had been confiscated, it had to be anglicized. The plan was to survey the territory to be planted and parcel it up into English acres and group it into English-style manors. They would be further organized into shires, baronies, and townships. So on the macro level as well as the micro level, the land is going to be organized and measured along English lines. And in addition to some rather obvious military provisions like a ban on helping the Irish rebels, I mean, obviously, there were some strictly cultural measures as well. Any Irish people living in the plantation had to adopt English dress, teach their children English, and attend the deputy annually. They had to abandon the Brehon law and use only English common law. And there was a penalty for marrying or fostering with the neighboring Irish. they were really supposed to turn their backs on their Irish past. Now, I need to make a point that's very important here about plantation. As we've seen, there are two controversial identity issues in Tudor Ireland: religious identity, Catholic versus Protestant, and cultural identity, Irish versus English. But these could operate independently of each other. The highly Anglicizing policy of plantation got its start under a Catholic monarch of England, Mary Tudor. For Mary, the status of the Irish as Catholics did not wipe out the problem of their being Irish. But because Mary died soon after plantation got underway, and the religious policy of the English government shifted with it, back to Protestantism, plantation quickly got associated in people's minds with Protestantism, and that turned out to be a toxic combination. It made those who didn't like plantation turn against Protestantism, and it made those who didn't like Protestantism resist plantation. Let's now turn back for a moment to the O'Neill family, who are the most important family in Ulster, in the north of Ireland, and we'll see how the problems of balancing the demands of both Irish and English identity played out. In 1559, Con O'Neill, the Earl of Tyrone, died, leaving two sons as claimants to the earldom: Matthew, the elder, and therefore the official English-sponsored claimant, and Shane, the younger, but the most prominent of the claimants under the Irish system. What were the English going to do? It would have been simplest to recognize Shane O'Neill as Earl, because Shane was the strongest claimant and a very able diplomat and military leader. But there were reasons not to recognize him. Shane had close ties to the Scots, who were not friendly towards the English at this point, and he was arming local peasants in an apparent effort to prepare for rebellion. Shane was clearly seen to be a serious threat to English rule in Ireland. The English Lord Deputy Sussex said of Shane, "If Shane be overthrown, all is settled. If Shane settle, all is overthrown." In June 1561, with the Queen's patience running out, Shane was invited to London for negotiations, and Shane's visit to London was a public relations triumph. The ladies of the court were apparently very intrigued by the handsome Shane and by his exotic followers with their long hair and their Irish-style clothes. But they also noted that he easily adapted to his courtly surroundings. The Irish elite was becoming bicultural. So peace seemed to be at hand. But then, totally unexpectedly, during Shane's visit to London, Shane's rival, Matthew O'Neill, was assassinated, and his killers threw their support behind a different O'Neill claimant named Turlough Linnich. And this led Shane to return to Ireland to try to fight for his rights among his own kin. And because he had broken the peace with the English government, he was now at war with England. It took nearly 5 years to suppress the rebellion, and in fact it only ended when Shane was forced to seek help from a local Ulster lord with Scottish connections named Alexander Oge MacDonald. Shane was received with signs of friendship, but then he was killed during a banquet, no doubt as part of a conspiracy with the English. Shane had not managed to balance the different political demands of the English world and the Irish world. But the O'Neills were not finished yet. Next, I want to look at the last major revolts in Ireland during the reign of Elizabeth I. The 9 Years' War, which began in 1593, dwarfed any previous rebellion in scope and size. It posed the most serious threat to English rule in Ireland, certainly since the Bruce invasion of the early 14th century, mainly because of the fear of Spanish intervention in Ireland. English and Irish forces in this revolt were well balanced, and it might, possibly, have turned out differently. The key figure in this revolt was a man named Hugh O'Neill. Hugh O'Neill was the second son of Matthew O'Neill, the English-sanctioned heir to the first Earl of Tyrone, Con O'Neill. Hugh had become the official English claimant to the earldom when he was only 12 years old. His childhood was very interesting because it shows us how these Irish noblemen were increasingly operating in two worlds, Irish and English. When Hugh became the heir, he was brought to the Pale, the area around Dublin that was culturally English, and then raised partly in England. So he was completely bilingual and, one might say, fully bicultural. He came back to Ireland in 1567 and served in Queen Elizabeth's army against the Irish rebels in southern Ireland. And he even fought with an English contingent that was aiding the Protestant rebels against Spanish rule in the Netherlands. Hugh was in fact hoping to have the best of both worlds, both culturally and politically. His goal was to combine both the English title, Earl of Tyrone, and the Irish chieftaincy, head of the O'Neills, in one person, himself. The trouble was that the claimant to the chieftaincy, who was around at the time of Shane's revolt, Turlochlinnich O'Neill, still had widespread support. So Hugh had his work cut out for him, and it took the better part of 3 decades for Hugh to work both systems and get both the English to recognize him as Earl of Tyrone and the Irish to recognize him as chieftain. But all of this careful work was undone by the 9 Years' War, which Hugh O'Neill did not actually start. It was started in 1593 by an alliance of other northern lords in combination with some prominent Catholic clerics. One of these clerics, Archbishop James O'Healy of Tuam, went to seek aid from the Spanish king, Philip II. Keep in mind that Philip had suffered a catastrophic and very embarrassing defeat at the hands of the English in 1588, just a few years before, with the Spanish Armada. The Armada had had a disproportionate impact on the north of Ireland. In most parts of the country, the bedraggled Spanish sailors who actually made it to shore after braving the storms of the seas north of Scotland had simply been slaughtered. In Ulster, however, some 3,000 of them had been rescued and given shelter, and 500 of those made it over to Scotland. So anything involving a Spanish connection was going to set off loud alarm bells in the English administration. The rebels had some early successes, but Hugh O'Neill was still on the fence, it seemed, trying hard to choose between his Irish compatriots and the English who had backed him against his O'Neill rivals. This is why the English could never entirely trust him. They were never sure how far gratitude and self-interest would go in keeping O'Neill in the English fold. And they were right to be a bit worried, since Hugh was actually in close touch with the Spanish court via one of Philip's agents. A government report on O'Neill summed up the English government's concern. If O'Neill's purpose is to rebel, it must proceed with a combination from Spain. His rebellion will be the more dangerous and cost the Queen more crowns than any other that have foregone him since Her Majesty's reign. And this prediction proved accurate in every respect. In the latter half of 1595, Hugh O'Neill quietly took over the reins of the conspiracy from Red Hugh O'Donnell, who had been the leader up until then. From this point on, O'Neill was in charge, though O'Donnell was his very close associate. Hugh O'Neill was a really good commander. He had served in the Queen's army, where he had learned how to train pikemen and musketeers, so he was up to date on the latest weaponry. He was, of course, hampered in his campaigning by a lack of heavy artillery. There was just no way for him to get the large field guns that the English had access to. But he countered this deficit by an effective use of guerrilla tactics. So what did the rebels want? First, autonomy for Ireland, sort of an early version of home rule, if you like. But they accepted that Ireland would remain under the English crown, so they're not actually demanding complete independence. Religion also played a role, at least in the rhetoric of the rebels. They demanded that the church in Ireland be wholly governed by the Pope. That is, they're effectively denying the royal supremacy. And that, under Elizabethan law, was clearly treason. And the result was the biggest, most unified rebellion in the 400-plus years of English rule in Ireland. And the campaigning took place over a far wider area of Ireland than ever before. Queen Elizabeth was so alarmed by O'Neill's success that she sent her current court favorite, Robert Devereux, Earl of Essex, to quash the rebellion in person. He went over with the most impressive army ever sent to Ireland, 16,000 troops. He had full viceregal powers. He had everything he needed to crush O'Neill. But what did he do instead? He received O'Neill's submission and made a truce with him. So Essex had squandered the best chance yet of beating O'Neill, and Elizabeth wasn't happy. He was summoned home, and knowing that he was in the doghouse, he started a rebellion himself as soon as he landed on English soil. He was caught and subsequently executed. But so much for that attempt to suppress O'Neill's revolt. Still, Elizabeth had other arrows in her quiver. She sent over a much better soldier in February of 1600 named Charles Blunt, Lord Mountjoy. He had an actual strategy in mind for crushing O'Neill. He wanted to isolate him in his Ulster base by building forts at key locations all along the border of the province, and he wanted to starve O'Neill into submission, to use famine as a weapon. Mountjoy may have gotten the idea of starving the Irish from a work by the famous English poet Sir Edmund Spenser, who had served for many years as a colonial official in Ireland until he was driven off his estates by the rebels. Spenser's book, entitled A View of the Present State of Ireland, drew on stereotypes of the Irish as thieves and murderers that went all the way back to Gerald of Wales in the 12th century. Here is Spenser on the Irish. "Marry, those be the most barbaric and loathly conditions of any people, I think, under heaven. They do use all the beastly behavior that may be. They oppress all men. They spoil as well the subject as the enemy. They steal. They are cruel and bloody, full of revenge, and delighting in deadly execution. Licentious, swearers and blasphemers, common ravishers of women, and murderers of children." These were the ideas that were shaping English policymakers in their response to the rebellion. Now, O'Neill knew that Mountjoy was going to be a lot tougher as an opponent than Essex had been, so he redoubled efforts that had been underway for some time to recruit help from Spain. In January of 1601, Philip III of Spain, who had succeeded his father 3 years earlier, promised to send 6,000 men to Ireland. But due to various setbacks, by the time the fleet landed on September 21st at Kinsale, just south and west of Cork City, there were fewer than 4,000 troops on board. And when they landed, it turned out that the local rebels had already been defeated. Given the lack of immediate local support, the Spanish commander, Don Juan de Laguila, decided to hunker down inside Kinsale and wait for O'Neill to join him. Mountjoy moved in to besiege Kinsale, but O'Neill rushed south from Ulster to try to meet up with his Spanish allies. Now, Mountjoy's army had the rebels on one side and the Spanish garrison on the other. O'Neill attacked, but the maneuver he tried to pull off proved too confusing for his troops. He simply overshot their ability to carry out his orders. And it came down to a straight-out fight between the cavalry of both sides. And Mountjoy prevailed. The Spanish never even came out of their fortress. And after negotiating rather cravenly for a week or so, they finally surrendered on January 2nd, 1602. The defeat at Kinsale was the beginning of the end. Hugh O'Neill's army made its way very laboriously back to Ulster in terrible weather, while O'Donnell went off to Spain to seek for more help, unsuccessfully, and he died there, possibly of poison. Hugh O'Neill knew he was effectively beaten. He merely went underground as his supporters gradually trickled in to sue for pardon from the English, including Rory O'Donnell, the brother of his old compatriot. By the beginning of 1603, Elizabeth just wanted it all over, so she gave Mountjoy authorization to offer O'Neill life, liberty, and a pardon. In March of 1603, O'Neill agreed. He hung on for 4 more years, hoping that he would be able to reach an accommodation with the English regime. But in the end, it proved impossible, and he, along with several companions, went into exile in 1607, never to return. The so-called Flight of the Earls can be said, with some oversimplification, to represent the end of the old Irish order. After departing from Lough Swilly in the north of Ireland, the Irish lords traced a path through all the major Catholic countries of Western Europe, and they finally landed in Rome. The Pope gave them pensions that were generous enough to allow them to live like gentlemen. O'Donnell died in July 1608 and was buried in the church of San Pietro in Montorio on the Janiculum Hill. O'Neill lived on, watched constantly by English agents, who reported that after dinner he had but one topic of conversation. His face would glow, he would strike the table, he would say that they would yet have a good day in Ireland. He never made it back to Ireland. And when he died in 1616, he was buried beside O'Donnell in Rome, where his grave can still be seen today. His arch-nemesis, the Lord Deputy, Sir John Davis, could hardly contain his glee. This is what he said, and notice his familiarity with the story about St. Patrick expelling the snakes from Ireland. "As for us that are here, we are glad to see the day wherein the countenance and majesty of the civil law and government hath banished Tyrone out of Ireland, which the best army in Europe and the expense of 2 millions of sterling pounds did not bring to pass. And we hope His Majesty's government will work a greater miracle in this kingdom than ever St. Patrick did. For St. Patrick did only banish the poisonous worms, but suffered the men full of poison to inhabit the land still. But His Majesty's blessed genius will banish all those generations of vipers out of it, and make it, ere it be long, a right fortunate island." One way the English were trying to make Ireland a fortunate island was by extending the policy of plantation to Ulster. The English government was determined to dilute the Irishness of this most rebellious province by importing settlers from England and the nearby Scottish lowlands. Now, the Scots of the lowlands, as I have pointed out in other lectures, were very different from the Scots of the highlands. The lowlanders did not have linguistic or ethnic ties to Ireland. In fact, they were speakers of a dialect of English known as Scots, which descended from the language spoken in northern England in the Anglo-Saxon period. Many people know a little Scots without realizing it. The famous song, "Auld Lang Syne," from a poem by Robert Burns, uses the Scots term for "old long since," or "long, long ago." Many of them were, in fact, ethnically the same as the English, though they had adopted a Scottish political identity. By this point, that Scottish political identity brought with it a fervent commitment to a very strong branch of Reformed Protestantism, strongly Calvinist in outlook, that was based on the work of John Knox. They were utterly opposed to the Catholic faith. The Protestant, English-speaking Scots and Englishmen were not going to mix very well with the Catholic, Irish-speaking Irish. There were also some Scots settlers from the Gaelic-speaking Western Islands of Scotland, but the English government made sure that they were staunch Protestants. The mood among the Irish in this period was glum. I'll just read a quick excerpt of a poem attributed to Farflacha O'Neave, the O'Neill court poet, and its title tells us that the Irish knew that they faced both political and cultural ruin. It is called "The Downfall of the Gaels." "Through the woods let us roam, through the wastes wild and barren. We are strangers at home, we are exiles in Erin." The English had finally succeeded in subduing the entire island of Ireland, and they had done so partly by attacking Irishness itself, which, from the English perspective, meant converting Ireland from savagery to civility.
Lecture 21, Rediscovering the Celts.
Welcome back. In this lecture, I will transition from focusing on the Celts themselves to the ways in which Celtic heritage was rediscovered by scholars and reappropriated by people in the Celtic areas who believed that connecting with the Celtic past had meaning for them in the present. Modern notions of Celtic nationalism all derive from this scholarly tradition that began in the 16th century. There is some irony involved in this story, and the Celtic traditions are not strangers to irony. Just as Ireland was being finally conquered by the English, and the Jacobite rebellions were leading to a decline in traditional Gaelic culture in the Highlands and Islands in Scotland, scholars were uncovering the relationships between the Celtic languages, and several important translations of supposedly ancient Celtic texts took the European literary world by storm. The Celtic phenomenon thus became wildly popular among non-Celtic speakers only after any conceivable military threat from actual Celts had largely disappeared. In this lecture, I will range very widely over the Celtic world, including a brief discussion of Ireland, but mostly focusing on Scotland and Wales. The story of the intersection between scholarship and the Celts begins in the late 16th century with a Scottish scholar named George Buchanan. He was the first to discover the linguistic relationship among the Celtic languages and to popularize the notion of a Celtic race. Buchanan had a colorful career. He briefly tutored the Catholic Mary Queen of Scots in Latin. But during Mary's reign, he converted to Presbyterianism. And after Mary was driven into exile, Buchanan became one of the tutors to the young James VI, who loathed Buchanan for lecturing him constantly about the limitations of the rights of kings and for making sure his royal charge got regular beatings. Buchanan was also instrumental in implicating the exiled queen in the murder of her second husband, Lord Darnley. So his political track record was interesting, to say the least. But for our purposes, it is Buchanan the scholar we need to focus on, not Buchanan the politician. A native speaker of Scottish Gaelic, as the word is pronounced in Scotland, Buchanan was also a phenomenally talented linguist who wrote prolifically in both Latin and Scots, the form of English spoken in Scotland. He was, in fact, a leading light of the European Renaissance. And here is where the two main parts of his intellectual makeup met. He had learned in his youth some of the more fanciful stories about where the Irish and the Scots had come from, that is, the traditions embodied in the Irish Book of Invasions, which had also been carried over into the Scottish traditions. This tradition traced the origins of the Scots and the Irish to Scythia in Central Asia, and even in some versions, to Troy. But being a skeptical Renaissance man, Buchanan did not believe them. So Buchanan decided to investigate the origins of the Scots, and by extension, the Irish, on his own terms. To do this, he invented a scholarly methodology, which was to investigate similarities in language and religion, and especially place names, among several different peoples. He identified place names with common elements, such as the lugh prefix that we see in places all over Europe, and that probably indicates a common cult of the god lugh. This kind of evidence helped Buchanan piece together the theory that the Celtic speakers of the British Isles were related to the Celtic speakers of continental Europe. He didn't get everything right. Although he believed the Picts were similar in language to the Celts, he saw the Picts as coming from Scythia, perhaps as a way of trying to rescue some part of the older tradition. Now we know that this is totally wrong. But the biggest contribution Buchanan made was clearly to make a connection between Britain and the continent, and to say, these are all Celts, they are one people. And this gave the Celtic speakers of Scotland a kind of classical credibility that was rather important in an age when the Celtic languages were under assault. Suddenly, Buchanan's fellow Celts were related to the people who had almost successfully defied Julius Caesar. Ironically, Buchanan's work on the origins of the Scots brought the stories of the Book of Invasions back into the headlines, so to speak. Because Buchanan was a major figure, his study of the Celts was widely read, and it prompted another extremely important intellectual, the English poet Sir Edmund Spenser, to weigh in on the question of the origins of the Irish. The reason is that Spencer spent several decades in the 1580s and 90s as a colonial administrator in Ireland. And he was actually driven from Ireland by rebels during the Nine Years' War in the 1590s. And in response, he wrote a blistering attack on Irish culture. One of the points he wanted to refute strongly was the connection that is made in the Book of Invasions between Ireland and Spain. It's not a mystery why this would be controversial in the 1590s. The English had just defeated the Spanish Armada in 1588, but Spain had responded to this defeat by making an alliance with the Irish rebels. So it was a good time to try to squelch any thought that there might be any sort of kinship between the Spanish and the Irish. But if people like George Buchanan and Sir Edmund Spencer were attacking the traditions embodied in the Book of Invasions, there were also scholars who passionately defended the historical value of these traditions, including an Irish Catholic priest named Seachún Caitín, known more commonly under his English name as Geoffrey Keating. Keating was from an Old English family, that is, a family that derived its descent from English settlers that had stayed Catholic. And he had obviously adopted an Irish cultural identity, though he remained loyal to the Stuart dynasty. He was also a product of the main intellectual currents in the late Renaissance, having studied at the Irish College in Bordeaux in France, which had been set up in the early 17th century to educate Irish Catholics, whose religion barred them from studying in English or Irish universities. Keating became fascinated by Irish history, and in 1634, he completed a book entitled Foras Fasa Ar Éireann, or The Foundation of Knowledge on Ireland. He could not print the book because it was explicitly pro-Catholic, but it did circulate in manuscript, and Keating's learned status helped to keep belief in the semi-legendary traditions of early Irish history alive well into the 18th century and beyond. The real scholarly progress on Celtic linguistics, though, was going to take place not in Ireland, but in the Brittonic world, about 100 years later, with the work of a French scholar named Paul-Yves Pezeron, who lived from 1639 to 1706. Pezeron was a Cistercian monk from Brittany, so he was familiar with the Breton language. In 1703, he published a book entitled Antiquité de la nation et de la langue celte autrement appelée gaulois, which was translated into English 3 years later as The Antiquities of Nations, more particularly of the Celti or Gauls. Pezeron is best known for coining the term Celtic language, and he saw similarities between the Celtic languages and Greek and Latin. Basically, Pezeron was reaching toward the methodology of comparative linguistics. He believed Breton was the last remnant of Gaulish, which he thought was derived from a language spoken at the time of the Tower of Babel. This was not exactly right, of course, since Breton was actually the speech of the immigrants from Britain who had arrived in Brittany in the 5th century, but he was at least in the right ballpark. And in fact, one of his most important contributions was to identify the connection between Breton and Welsh, and from now on, the Welsh, too, were seen to be Celts. And when Pezeron's work was translated into English, it was in fact a Welshman who picked up the ball and ran with it. Edward Clwyd, who lived from 1660 to 1709, was the curator of the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford University, and he ran in exalted intellectual circles. He was a friend of Sir Isaac Newton. Clwyd was very aware of what was going on in the field of early Celtic studies, and he was a great admirer of Pezeron. Clwyd compared vocabulary words from Welsh, Irish, Scottish Gaelic, Cornish, and Breton. And his great contribution was to bring all the Celtic languages together for the first time. It's interesting that he personally did not want to use the term Celtic for the languages of the British Isles and Ireland, but he did see the relationships between them, and he made a crucial discovery. Clwyd was the first to recognize the sound changes between Welsh and Irish, that is, the distinction between Q-Celtic and P-Celtic we discussed in earlier lectures. Clwyd also invented the terms Goidelic and Brittonic for the speakers of Q Celtic and P Celtic, respectively, and he named them after characters in the Book of Invasions. So by the early 18th century, scholars had made huge strides in recognizing the kinship between the Celtic languages and also how they should be classified with regard to each other. Up until this point, nobody really knew that the Irish and the Welsh had anything in common other than hating the English. This scholarly work on the Celtic languages crossed over into popular culture in the 18th century in a huge way, partly driven by current events. And this is when I need to do a brief digression into the story of the Jacobites. The Jacobites were, of course, the fanatical, romantic faction that supported the exiled Stuart family, the descendants of James VII of Scotland and II of England, who had been driven from both the English and Scottish thrones in 1688 for being completely incompetent and gratuitously offensive to their subjects. The Jacobites get their name from the name Jacobus, which is simply the Latin form of James. A brief spoiler alert, the Jacobites ultimately lost. But between 1689 and 1745, there was a whole series of attempts, some of them more well-developed than others, to restore the Stuarts to the British throne. The last attempt ended in April 1746 with the catastrophic defeat at the Battle of Culloden of James II's grandson, Charles Edward Stuart, better known as Bonnie Prince Charlie. The British commander, the Duke of Cumberland, younger son of King George II, became known for his savage reprisals against the Jacobites as the Butcher of Culloden. And by the way, this nickname was given to him by his own brother. The British government's reaction to the Jacobite Rising of 1745 had very important ramifications for the story of the Celts. Let's go back for a moment to the Battle of Culloden. This battle is often popularly believed to have been a clash between Highlanders on the Jacobite side and Lowlanders and Englishmen on the government side. And this is emphatically not the case. There were speakers of Scottish Gaelic on both sides of the conflict. There is some beautiful Gaelic poetry that mourns the death of the Jacobite soldiers. But on the other hand, one of the most intriguing artifacts that was retrieved from the battlefield was a Gaelic Bible that belonged to a soldier loyal to King George. But the British government did not see the situation with this kind of nuance. Instead, they associated all Highlanders with rebels, and they decided to carry out the kind of anglicizing policy that had been pursued in Ireland at the time of the Tudor conquest there. Let's try to get these people to look and act more like Englishmen, or at least Lowland Scots. So in 1746, the British passed the Dress Act of 1746, which banned the use of tartan, the distinctive multicolored checked cloth worn in the Highlands, except that Scottish regiments could use it within the British Army. Now, the idea behind banning tartan was clearly to undermine the solidarity of the Highland clans and also to try to assimilate the Highlanders into Lowland culture. There's an interesting parallel here to the efforts made by the English in Ireland to get the Irish to dress in the English manner. The Dress Act was widely resented, and in fact, it ended up creating a kind of radical tartan chic. But let's back up and do a quick history of tartan and why it matters. Its origins are obscure. Tartan-like textiles were produced in the 8th to the 6th centuries BC in the Hallstatt culture in Central Europe, and remains of such textiles were actually discovered in 2004. But since we also see similar patterns in Western China, it's hard to say how distinctive they are, much less to make a direct connection between, say, Hallstatt and Scotland. The earliest surviving fragment of a British tartan dates to the 3rd century AD from a pot found at Falkirk in Stirlingshire, which is just north of the Antonine Wall. It was found in a pot with 2,000 Roman coins. But tartan was also used in Jutland in Denmark around the same time. But then we have a hiatus where it's not mentioned. We just don't have any evidence about it. Tartan, as we think of it, next appears in the 16th century, when we suddenly find lots of references in written sources to striped or checked plaids. And by the late 17th and early 18th centuries, standardized forms had developed. A Gaelic-speaking scholar with the rather unprepossessing name of Martin Martin wrote a book in 1703 called A Description of the Western Islands of Scotland. In this book, he noted that the different islands and regions had their own patterns of tartan. And this is just how the weavers in that area happened to produce the cloth, based on what local dyes were available. But note that this is a regional thing, not a clan thing. There would be some overlap, of course, between region and clan, but nobody is yet claiming that there is a Campbell tartan or a MacDonald tartan. And you might have had MacDonalds who lived in different valleys wearing different tartans. The one place where tartans really are standardized, ironically, was in the British Army. A group of Highlanders could be a riotously colorful bunch, so there was a drive to standardize their tartans by regiment. And ironically, this standardization within the British Army may have ultimately led to the idea of clan tartans, about which I'll say more shortly. But of course, by forbidding the wearing of tartan for civilians in 1746, the English were almost inevitably creating a mystique around tartan, and the odd effect seems to have been to expand the meaning of tartan from a marker of Highland or Gaelic identity to a marker of Scottish identity writ large. And tartan was not the only Celtic phenomenon that was controversial in the 18th century. I want to talk now about one of the most famous literary debates of all time. It concerns a series of poems published beginning in 1760 by the Scottish poet James Macpherson, who claimed that these poems were translations from an ancient book written in Gaelic. The poems drew on tales familiar from Irish tradition, such as the stories from the Finn cycle about the great hero Finn MacCool and his son Oisin, who travels across the sea to the other world with his fairy lover, only to return and discover that 300 years have passed in Ireland in what seemed to him the blink of an eye. Oisin is cast as the bardic narrator of the poems, and they also include references to the Ulster cycle stories about the hero Cuchulainn. Now let me give you a sample of what this text sounds like. Cuchulainn sat by Tura's wall. He spoke like a wave on a rock. Who in this land appears like me? Heroes stand not in my presence. They fall to earth from my hand. Who can meet Swarin in fight? Who but Fingal, king of Selma of storms? Once we wrestled on Malmore. Our heels overturned the woods. Rocks fell from their place. Rivulets, changing their course, fled murmuring from our side. 3 days we renewed the strife. Heroes stood at a distance and trembled. I think Macpherson is probably capturing an 18th century sensibility rather than that of the ancient bards, but he did his job supremely well. These poems were hugely popular. They were translated into all the major European languages, and they had a huge influence on Romanticism. Napoleon supposedly loved the poems, and they inspired works of art and music, such as Felix Mendelssohn's overture entitled Fingal's Cave, named for a natural rock formation in the Inner Hebrides that received this name in tribute to Macpherson's poems. But if the general public fell hard for Oisin, who was proclaimed in some quarters the Celtic equivalent of Homer, some members of the literary establishment began to raise questions right away. First, Irish people were angry that these texts were claimed for Scotland. But more seriously, doubts were raised about the authenticity of the poems. Where were the original texts on which these so-called translations were based? Macpherson never produced them. Samuel Johnson, the famous compiler of the first real English dictionary, said Macpherson was a mountebank, a liar, and a fraud, and that the poems were forgeries. He was asked, "But Dr. Johnson, do you really believe that any man today could write such poetry?" He replied, "Yes, many men, many women, and many children. Of course, Johnson hated Gaelic, which he called the rude speech of a barbarous people. But others leapt to Macpherson's defense. Scottish author Hugh Blair's defense in 1763 was included in every edition of the poems thereafter. But Irish author Charles O'Connor said it was a forgery, and the controversy continued.